Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Welcome back to another week of the Inside Lacrosse D1 Men's Podcast with your hosts, Dan Flynn and Terry Foy.
What's up, T-Fly?
Hey, T-Foy, what is shaking, my man? We've had an interesting week. You have a good weekend?
It's okay. I'm a little under the weather, which, kind of felt like I started to get this coming on around 9:25 on Saturday morning.
Yeah.
When your boy Alexi Sanchez, surrounded by nine guys.
Well, that's what makes him world class.
Equalized.
He hasn't been very good for Arsenal the last few weeks since he's been out injured, and he's just getting back into form, I believe.
That's what they call class on the other side of the pond.
It's so funny that in every big game, it seems like the Gunners do something that is so Arsenal-y, and getting a man sent off is a common. It happened against Barcelona in the Champions League a couple weeks ago. It's just like the pressure just swallows them up.
Whereas my boys, the Dillon Panthers of the English Premier League, who are coached by a guy that I don't even understand how it's a question whether Mauricio Pochettino looks like Kyle Chandler. I mean, they're dead ringers for each other. I know what Kyle Chandler's
role
is going to be.
You mean
Coach Taylor.
Coach T.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Well, the actor that plays him has a real name. I know that, you know, Connie Britton has suffered from
wife. Even when I see him in other movies and stuff, I'm like, hey, it's Coach T.
Well,
and there's
right.
Mrs. T.
Yeah, and when he played an FBI agent in Wolf of Wall Street, you expected him to pull out a whistle when he was sitting on top of Jordan Belfort's boat.
Well, I thought he would listen to him more.
So anyhow, Mauricio Pochettino's team, which has run more than any Premier League team in the history of the league, 580-some miles over the course of the season, just gets better as the game goes along. And that's exactly what happened. So after your boy Coughlin got sent off.
Coughlin.
Yeah. Then it was time to shine, and I was on top of the world at about 9:15, up 2-1, White Hart Lane. We have a title in our sights, and here we are. It's funny how quickly expectations change. 10 days ago would have been completely content with a top four finish, but having more to do with what we've seen negatively out of Man City and Man United, I'm in a title or bust type of mood, and then,
You need to take a page out of the Arsene Wenger playbook and just being in the top four, man. That's all we shoot for. We aim right for mediocrity on a high level.
Right. Yeah, and you do it for 12 consecutive years.
So Terry, last week I talked about the three games, my big day on Sunday, and I went 0-3. This week I fared a little bit
better. It was on Saturday. You think that had a lot to do with it?
Possibly. Sunday was apparently my team's day of rest. And they took advantage of it last week. This week, the Blue Jays bounced back with a much-needed win at Homewood Field against Princeton in my sort of matinee game after the draw. And then my favorite basketball team took a tough loss at home to finish the day. But it was a fine day.
One and one.
Yeah. Much better than the trifecta of suckitude the week before. But we were on the road last week a little bit.
That's probably the biggest reason I'm actually under the weather.
Yeah.
Just being surrounded by too many travel germs.
But earlier in the week, we were talking about the Premier League. You went to a pretty cool conference. And what were some of your takeaways from the Leaders in Sport?
Yeah, so Leaders in Sport is an organization that is under the same corporate umbrella as Inside Lacrosse. And they're London-based. And they primarily have been a performance-based kind of symposium-type circuit, and really heavy in soccer. So they had a sport industry summit at the Time Center in New York City, and Ashley McCullough and I, a new convert to the podcast listenership, took the train up Tuesday morning and checked it out. It was great. There was, like you mentioned, a lot of representatives from the Premier League and world football at large. So
did the president or the GM of Everton speak?
Yeah, the CEO of Everton was among the chief commercial officer.
Raj, shout out Raj Bennett.
And then the actual a former chairman of the Premier League and executive from Sky Sport also spoke, and that was more about kind of the future of live television, and particularly as it related to digital rights and man, TV is so different in Europe than it is in the United States. It's wild.
Ash said that guy was dynamic and a great speaker, and but also was fascinated by the way that the TV market works in Europe.
Yeah, so it was a great day, and you know, we're excited about the things that we were able to learn and take away and hopefully implement in our business going forward.
Yeah. And then we were also on the road together for a trip. We went out to
the greatest city in the world. The Paris of Northeast Ohio. You like that one? You know, it's an audio podcast. Typically, if you're going to lose it while laughing, it's better to do so into the microphone.
I like Cleveland. We met one of my best friends lives is from up that way, and we were able to catch up with
him.
I
am also from up that way.
Yeah, well, that's who I was talking about. But another one of my best friends from college.
I laughed in the microphone.
Met us out, and we caught up with a couple other guys, Dylan Sheridan and Andy German, the coaches at Cleveland State, to watch the Virginia.
As well as Dylan's lovely wife, Brianne Tierney.
Yeah. A good time. We went to
Quaker Steak and Lube.
Who Terry has a long history with.
100%. Not long enough. I started going to that place when I was in high school. They had to have all-you-could-eat wings on Thursday nights. I want to say that the amount of wings I've, the amount of Quaker Steak wings I've eaten on Thursday nights alone is in the four figures.
Terry was telling a story that two of his buddies from high school, they had this running competition one summer, and it was tied at the end of the summer in a bunch of different tasks.
Yeah, it was like chess, beach volleyball, singing.
And so they decided to break the tie with a wing-eating competition at Quaker Steak.
I mean, I thought that they both had triple figures in sights. I mean, this was like one of those eye of the tiger type moments. We were outside. It was the night before school started. One guy took his shirt off at a picnic table. I mean, it was high society. The final ended up being 79-77. Mike Harakis, future Lafayette Leopard soccer player, took it home.
So you were quite impressed by those numbers. I have a personal friend, Crazy Legs Conti, who is a professional eater.
It's a whole different world.
And those numbers, I laughed when I heard that because I said, how long? Was this in 15 minutes? And you said, no, it was in 3 hours.
It was an endurance show.
Okay.
Well, it was an eat until you couldn't eat anymore.
Well, what was the SHU that they were using?
I would estimate it averaged out somewhere in the 1500 range.
This place takes its like wing hotness very seriously, and they have this big temperature gauge on the back of the menu. But we saw the game, some really good lacrosse play, a fun game. We talked last week about how we were hoping to see that game meet the rivalry of old, of maybe like 5 years ago or something, when that was the two up and down, fun, entertaining games, and it was that way. And we'll get into that in a little bit. But we also went to visit our friends at Unitas, and who has been basically the presenting sponsor of our recruiting events, our summer events, and saw some new stuff that they have, some of their new line and how they've expanded their business, the uniforms. They also do soccer and volleyball as well as lacrosse, and really good things from those guys.
Yeah, and the big takeaway for me is they believe in, you know, diversifying what they do. So it's a cutting and printing and gluing and adhesing and sewing type company that's made its bones in the automotive industry that, you know, saw a lot of opportunity in the uniform space as well. So really fortunate to have them as a partner, and it was really nice to visit with them.
And unlike some other companies that are in that uniform business, these guys, we saw people sewing the uniforms in their factory in Solon, Ohio, which is kind of cool to have American-made products that we can help support and that our people wear when they come to an Inside Lacrosse event.
No doubt.
How about some news and notes, Terry?
Well, so you mentioned, obviously, Johns Hopkins, substantial win over the Princeton Tigers. And since we last spoke a week ago Monday, Zach Currier was suspended for an incident that was described both as throwing a ball at a referee as well as rolling a ball toward a referee. Which is probably an important distinction. Unfortunately, while the game was televised, and by the game we're referring to Hofstra's overtime win over the Tigers at the Dutch Dome a week ago Saturday, there was a call-in dispute toward the end of the game that we did discuss. Currier looked to have his legs taken out from the side / behind him. No call. Hofstra comes down, scores, game over, boom. And then you can see in the video, Zach first reacting emotionally, hitting his stick against the goal, then picking up the ball, and then moving in the direction of the referees. And then he moves out of frame. Some of his teammates essentially go after him, and then they bring him back. So that's essentially the extent of what we know. Referee's report came out after the game. He had been ejected, technically, and as a result was suspended the subsequent game. In talking with Inside Lacrosse, Coach Chris Bates expressed disappointment that there isn't a review or appeal opportunity that could be pursued and kind of bring in a more impartial third party than the dispute between the referees and the team/player, which I actually kind of understand his point. At the same time, you kind of know that, and everybody plays by those rules. It's a function of – it's a little bit harsh in the sense that if that were to have occurred not after the game ended, it seems like, based on the characterization of both the referee's report, how it was written in the box score, as well as speaking to some other folks who had some knowledge of the incident, that it probably would have been a 3-minute unsportsmanlike, non-releasable type penalty. So there's a 57-minute gap that the player served. Now, granted, obviously the Tigers were not a man down for 60 minutes against Johns Hopkins, although some Princeton fans might say that they looked like it. It was certainly had a bearing on the way that, Princeton was going to be able to play against Johns Hopkins, because he's so dynamic in the middle of the field, Currier is, and that had been a place that Hopkins had demonstrated some issues in terms of their ability to clear the ball, just their overall athleticism between the lines. They got a goal out of Derek Cambo in this game. They looked much better in transition than they had in their previous three outings. So, disappointing, obviously, for Princeton not to have one of their very best players.
Yeah, he used the word dynamic, and that's the way he's almost like a throwback midi, does it all. It affects a lot of the game. Was great against Hopkins last year. Probably was the man of the match in their win over JHU a year ago, and it definitely affected them. The Canada U19 roster came out, Terry, for this summer's FIL U19 games, which will be in British Columbia
in July.
July, and there were some interesting names on it, or were you just impressed by how good it looked, how deep it was?
I think more than anything else, the easiest way to say is it's kind of hard to know. I'm not intimately familiar with their tryout process, and there are some names on this roster that I have far less familiarity with than I would any of the 25 guys that are currently sitting on the U19 U.S. roster. That being said, there are obviously some notable names that guys like Jeff Teat, who have been on the radar for a very long time. I think the thing that you take away from this process more than anything else is just it's got to be really, really exciting to represent your team, your nation on your home soil. So, first of all, congratulations to the 24 guys that have made it to this stage in the process. And then secondly, really excited to see how it all comes together. I think that there are a couple of elements that'll be interesting to watch. So, I mentioned Jeff Teat. He and Ethan Walker are the two attackmen that I expect will kind of set the tone. That'll be exciting to watch. Certainly guys like Ben French and Thomas Semple have made, impressive statements over this point of their kind of like public whatever it is, persona development. You start to get to build a little bit more familiarity with them, but Teat and Walker are the two that from a recruiting standpoint have certainly been on the radar the longest. Probably helps that they play for Culver and Hill Academy respectively, and that's going to get you on a lot of American fans' radar. And then the other element of this that I'll be interested in, Justin Anasio is a faceoff guy that has bona fide chops, and the faceoff position has been one that has been an issue in international competitions for Canada when Jeff Snyder is not available, be it because he's older than 19 or any other reason. And you saw in that scrimmage at IMG in January how impressive how much not an issue it seemed like the faceoffs were going to be, particularly given the fact that Canada was able to win a faceoff with less than 7 seconds to go, throw the ball at the goal, and get a game-winning goal in what I would say, and we'll get to this in a sec, if the Carolina-Denver game had ended in regulation, that was the only matchup or the only finish that would have superseded over this point of the season.
One more news and note. The MLL has announced they're going to play their All-Star game in Southern California, Cal State Fullerton, in a move that the thing that I found interesting out of that is that they have a desire to have a team in Southern California and to expand the league again. You know, there was the San Francisco Dragons, there was the LA Riptide.
That's right.
And those teams were contracted, but it looks like they're trying to expand there.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, this is actually a perfect segue into, you know, one of the things that we'll talk about when we talk about the game, but the games. But Notre Dame versus Maryland got nearly 7,000 fans in Southern California. GW Mix is the basically proprietor that made that happen, you know, and credit to him for all of the effort. We talked last week at length about how difficult a lot of those neutral site games can be. And there's no question that if the right ownership group is in place, Major League Lacrosse should be in Southern California, particularly if the right venue is in place as well. So the Home Depot Center is where the LA Riptide played their games during their iteration. And, you know, it's a relatively good location. It's a little bit more toward L.A. than where a lot of the lacrosse is being played, whether it be in Orange County or, you know, north of the city. But it's relative, you know, it's not that far from the highway. People are familiar with getting there, whether it be for a soccer game or any of the other dozens of athletic events that go on there. So, you know, I'll be interested in what the reaction is for Fullerton because, you know, it's a different venue. It's a little bit more in the mix of where a lot of that kind of Orange County lacrosse is being played. So, you know, we'll be fascinated to see how it plays out. I you know, applaud the MLL and Commissioner Gross for making the decision to head out there and see how it plays.
So last year the All-Star game was in Houston. Is that also an expansion city that they're looking at?
Yeah, so they were essentially all but done, all but dialed in to play in Houston. It wasn't going to be in the BBVA Compass Stadium where the All-Star game was. It was going to be the University of Houston's new football complex. And it was one of those 11th hour things where they thought they had some agreements in place that they didn't in terms of the local ownership group. But apparently the local sports commission is very much interested in bringing MLL to Houston. So I think it's still alive, but it certainly is not as close as it appeared at times last summer. I mean, it was to the point where we had a story prepared announcing Georgia and Houston as locations. And thankfully held off until it became clear what the Houston situation was, and then obviously ended up reporting that Georgia was getting a team first. So enjoyed that one.
On to the games, Terry.
Let's do it. So I was told last week that the chips and guac are not as audible as you might hope.
It doesn't have the distinguished ring to it as opening up the... Ah, there you go.
You think Diet Coke will want to sponsor our podcast?
Yes, I think
it goes very well.
Or just Coke in general.
Well,
Coke,
right,
Cola.
Yeah, Coca-Cola Company.
Yeah,
you got any
yens
over there?
They do go really well together.
Chips and guac and...
Yeah.
Do you want one?
Oh, no, thank you.
No, you're supposed to say yes, even if you don't eat one.
I know, but you're sick, and I don't want to share your guac with you. But Terry will be breaking open his chips and guac as we get on to the games. One of the more exciting games of the week, something we heard a few times this weekend was it felt like a postseason style game, and that certainly was the case down at Chapel Hill. North Carolina runs out to a 6-4 lead at the half, but then a 7-2 Denver run over the next 23 minutes gave Denver an 11-8 lead with about 6.5 minutes left. Carolina wasn't done. Michael Tagliaferri initiates a 4-0 run for the Tar Heels.
And that was unbelievable.
Yeah. But Denver ends up getting a 13-12 overtime win, and there's a lot to talk about and unpack with this one.
Yeah, so I think this is the important place to start because certainly it looked for a good 2.5 minutes like the number two team in the country was about to fall, that Carolina was going to get a win that they got last year as well, you know, as they knocked off the Pios when they came to town en route to their national championship season. I think that, well, before diving into this game in particular, I want to prepare everybody for a theme that I took away from this game as well as the next game we're going to talk about, which is Maryland's loss to Notre Dame, as well as the Virginia one-goal loss to Syracuse, which is that I feel a lot better about each losing team than I did prior to the weekend. And with Carolina in particular, it was their offensive potency. Now, you can point to Alex Reddy, I believe, only stopping 33% as one of the issues. And, you know, there's obviously some meat on that bone. But I think what was most impressive to me was the diversity of scoring that Carolina was able to demonstrate. Luke Goldstock got back into the game, 2 goals and 2 assists. Patrick Kelly had one rip on the run, right-handed down the alley. That was really impressive as he continues to transition from attack to midfield. And Steven Pontrello looked pretty dangerous and pretty explosive at times behind the goal. So, you know, that was a sign of, you know, some positive momentum in terms of the Carolina offense. And obviously down the stretch, that was certainly the case as well. But I think that the differentiating factor, the reason that Denver came away with the W, is because of their composure, their poise, all of those relatively difficult to define characteristics that separate championship teams. And so I would argue that when DU went up, I believe it was 11-9 with about 6 minutes to go, the game should have been over. So credit to Carolina for being able to make a run late and get back into contention. That being said, you're up 12-11 with about a minute and a half, minute and 10 seconds to go. The first thing I noticed was that Denver got the ball, and they did not feel the need to go to the goal immediately. They got one kind of half-hearted look and then called timeout with about 30 seconds left. Coming out of the timeout with about 30 seconds left down a goal, you would think you're going to go pretty quickly just because you don't want to run out of time while you're still going through your offense. I think they got the ball around once or twice. It wasn't even the first opportunity, the first goal-scoring opportunity that Denver got that they ended up converting on. It was after a deflected shot, Zach Miller got the ball and just buried a laser. It was awesome. So now all of a sudden it looks like the game's going to overtime. I believe there was 7 seconds left. No, let's give one more potential clean look to Connor Cannizzaro, and I can't describe the type of shot he took. It was both kind of backhanded, kind of a scoop shot, but it was from like, looked like 14 or 15 yards out, and it hit Brian Balcombe center mast. I mean, it was one of those where you didn't need to move and you made the save, but you can understand if he did move and the ball got in. And if he had, oh my goodness, I referenced earlier that Canada U19 upset win over the United States when they came from behind in January, and this would have topped that. It was an unbelievable play. That being said, ball don't lie, overtime, come back out, Connor Cannizzaro ends it, 3 goals, 2 assists on the day. I mean, I made the comment during the game that he is very easily and very justifiably you're the best player in the game. But it's not for the reasons that you typically define. Like, there was so much about Lyle Thompson that a coach would never tell his player to do, but he's just so good that you can't tell him not to do it. Well, Connor Cannizzaro, he's a coach's dream. I mean, the fact is, he doesn't do anything wrong. He's just really explosive, really quick, really smooth. So well coached. I don't know. It's easy to look at him and just say, you look like an upstate New York player. He was just so excellent in this one.
And he got some help. 4 Pios end up with 5 points. Zach Miller with 4 and 1, Bobson with 3 and 2, and Tyler Pace, 2 goals and 3 assists to help join him for the Tar Heels. Tagliaferro hat trick, Patrick Kelly a hat trick, and Luke Goldstock has 2 goals and 2 assists. Moving forward, it doesn't get any easier for Denver. What they're going for, I think they want to be ACC champs, and they can get it if they get the win over Notre Dame this weekend. But
more on that one to come.
Yeah, but the Carolina team, what do you see for them moving forward, Terry?
Well, it's interesting. So they've got UMass next, and that's a game that contrasting styles, can we say that? You know, certainly Garber's Gorillas are not, they don't come to town with the, you know, polished reputation that Carolina does. That said, Tar Heels are going north. It's probably going to be pretty cold. And this is an opportunity for UMass to make another statement. So certainly they got a lot of attention, deservedly so, with their win over Ohio State on February 20th. But they're 2-3, most recently with a loss to Brown. They don't have a bad loss. I mean, a 4-goal loss to Army to open the season and then a 1-goal loss to Harvard. UMass is a good team and a team that Carolina needs to take seriously. And I think they will. I think Carolina is in a position where, you know, they can't really overlook anybody at 3-2. You know, certainly they demonstrated a nice bounce back effort against Topkins after losing to Hofstra in a game where they were outplayed in pretty much every facet. And I think that this is one that you kind of feel like you need to get if you're Carolina in order to feel good about yourselves. You know, they've got Manhattan and Richmond on the heels of that. But then, you know, you're essentially getting into your ACC schedule beyond as you turn the corner into late March.
One of the other big games we referenced already, let's move on to Notre Dame defeats Maryland 9-4 on Saturday in front of an announced crowd of 6,970 at LeBard Stadium in Orange County, California, in the Pacific Coast Shootout. It was a close game. If 9-4 grinding out a win, Kevin Corrigan said that was not a 9-4 game. Anybody that was here knows that was felt more like a 1-2 goal game. Mikey Wynn, big game for the Irish with 4 goals. We talked last week about would Maryland have a new wrinkle, and they did. They started Colin Heacock at attack, and even had a bit of a trick play. But overall, it was the fans in Southern California got their money's worth.
Yeah, it was interesting. Jacqueline Borowski, our photographer, made the trip out, and I was just talking to her about the game. And, you know, she was like, oh, it was a great, great environment, great atmosphere. And I was like, oh, man, it was a bummer that they didn't get treated to a more exciting game. And she's like, well, yeah, but, you know, it felt like it flew by. No media timeouts because it wasn't on TV, and enough action pacing, you know, each end. And I couldn't argue with that. It made sense. But, you know, diving into the meat of this game, if I didn't mention a defensive player's name in the Denver-Carolina game, I don't know, with the exception of the previously mentioned Mikey Wynn, how important it is to talk about an offensive player coming away from this one. First of all, Matt Landis was the best player on the field. I mean, you know, there was some conversation about Shane Doss as the MVP of this game. To me, Landis, with 3 caused turnovers and so many more just turned away dodges. Last year, Landis had a reputation as a blanket. You could put him on somebody. You weren't going to have to slide to him. He was going to take his matchup out of the game. You know, certainly what he was able to do in limiting Lyle Thompson garnered a lot of notoriety, rightfully so. This year, this game in particular, what I saw was a combination of his sliding and hedging that turned back Maryland Dodgers, with the fact that it almost felt in the second half like Maryland just didn't have that much desire to get into the teeth of the defense. And I think that it was because of how active Landis was with his stick, how disciplined he was with his approaches, and how difficult he was to actually get past or shoot around or make a pass through once you actually beat your initial man if he was the guy that was sliding to you. I was so impressed with that in terms of his ability to stay focused again and again and again. And, you know, there comes a point when you're talking about Matt Landis where you're just like, seriously? Like, more with this guy? I mean, he's legitimately a model. And over the last week, I ran across an activation that the men's lacrosse team did at a Notre Dame hockey game in which he apparently had an opportunity to meet Miss Indiana and participate in a tricycle race on the ice. So, Matt Landis, you're the winner of the week as it relates to living life correctly. And I saw today that Notre Dame is at Camp Pendleton, which is a Marine base in Southern California. They're really enjoying themselves. So, deserved after a win, which I want to echo both yours, Kevin Corrigan's, and Quinn's comments about this game not being a 5-goal margin. I mean, it was 5-4 with probably 7.5 minutes to go. Notre Dame scored to go up 6-4 with probably around 4 minutes to go. And then after that, Maryland immediately started doubling with their goalie, and the last 3 goals were all scored on empty nets. So, you know, it was a 5-4, 6-4 type game that really hinged on a couple of plays that came after Maryland was unable to clear, which is kind of the other thing that I want to say. I mentioned at the top that I was really impressed by some of the losing teams, and Maryland fits the bill for me. Obviously, they have woes offensively. We talked about it last week. You mentioned that they made some changes heading into this one. But for a team where we weren't sure what Matt Dunn's status was going to be, they already lost Brian Neufeldt, who I thought was their top long stick midfielder, at the beginning of the season, in the fall with a torn ACL. I really like their long stick personnel. I thought Kyle Bernlohr played with a lot of energy in this one. But whether it's Tim Muller, Mac Pons, I thought Greg Danseglio, to me, he's always been a pure, a close defenseman. And so when I was hearing about him playing pole, I was a little bit skeptical. But he does a nice job playing around the top of the box. He makes life difficult for guys. He probably has among the best physique to match up with a guy like Sergio Perkovic. So I was just very impressed. And then when you combine that with the fact that Isaiah Davis-Allen, you mentioned a trick play, got a goal, got Maryland's fourth goal through a substitution game, and has clearly emerged as, you know, near the center of the emotional heart for Maryland, it's clear that they're a team that builds from the back out. And I actually think that it's going to be reflected in the way that their season unfolds, because I think their offense is going to get better. You know, this is a coaching staff that has earned and deserves their fan base's trust and analysts' trust as well. I mean, they just routinely overcome and exceed expectations to get back to championship weekend. And until they don't, I'm going to go down on the ship of Maryland is going to continue to improve at a rate that exceeds a lot of their opponents. And this year it happens to be that that improvement is going to have to happen at the offensive end of the field. If it includes Colin Heacock pairing with Matt Rambo to lead the attack, then I can see how that would be fruitful, particularly if it ends up with Pat Young on the first line. I thought he was the Dodger that was most willing to take some punishment against Notre Dame. Did a little bit, showed some spark, and I think that, you know, that's going to be something that we're going to see more of going forward.
Maryland gets right back at it tomorrow. So they fly back to the East Coast and play at Drexel tomorrow, and that with a game against Princeton coming up this weekend. Could be a trap game.
Tuesday's for the Hunter.
That's right.
Quinn stole that from Andy Shea. I called him out for it. His comment was, it doesn't matter who says it. It matters who the most famous person that says it is. Tuesday is for the Hunter is something that I think we're going to hear a few times over the next couple of weeks. And certainly Drexel in this case is the Hunter. I mean, you know, there are a few teams that over the last 5 years, if you get a win over them, you can count them as a likely top five win. Right now, I would say that that group is Denver, Notre Dame, Maryland, and Duke. If you beat one of those four teams, you can assume within reason that you're going to have a top five RPI win at the end of the year. And if you have a top five RPI win at the end of the year, it's typically going to be the differentiating factor between whether you get in or in off the bubble or whether you host a home game. In Drexel's case, you assume that this is the type of win that if they get, gets them in their at-large conversation. That being said, it, based on the way they've played so far, it's hard to imagine that outcome.
Now, this game, the Maryland-Notre Dame game, also featured your broadcast webcast observation of the week, Terry.
Well, first of all, shout out to Max Lax OC for getting this on the airwaves. Also, shout out to them for not closing the comments of the live event because they were on fire throughout this game. There was one moment in particular that I wanted to call out. I really was impressed by the fans in attendance decision to flash their cell phones at each other from opposite sides of the stadium. If you fast forward to around the 2 hour and 34 minute mark of this game, there was a really cool moment when it looked like there was small spaceships landing on the opposite side of the field. You know, this was a game that last year was not able to be seen, the North Carolina-Maryland game. So when you sell out, you really don't have to worry about whether your broadcast is going to undercut your attendance. So, you know, it was cool. It was pretty wild. I mean, that reminds you of...
We're looking at it right now.
A few concerts that you've been to where the lighters go up in the air during some ballad or other.
Yeah. Of course.
Any in particular stand out in your memory?
A Pearl Jam concert or something. Springsteen, maybe.
Just like...
Justin Bieber.
What Springsteen song is most lighter in the air worthy?
Well, at the end of his shows, when he plays Born to Run, all the house lights come on. So no matter what time it is. And now I've implemented that in my personal life. I'm driving down the road in my car.
You turn on the overhead light?
If it's in noon or whether it's midnight, overhead lights in the car go on.
Have you ever forgotten to turn? Like, it's you do it at noon.
I've had a dead battery or once or twice.
Thanks for Born to Run.
Thunder Road is definitely turn the get the lighter out for Thunder Road. There's a lot. I mean, there's a lot of quality Springsteen songs that are made for that kind of thing.
Streets of Philadelphia?
It's a little depressing. It's not so much of a, maybe not that one, Terry.
What would you say is like your all-time number one ballad?
Well, I will say, I just heard Thunder Road in the car the other day with my 2-year-old daughter in the back seat. I drove around the block twice. I said, Hannah, you got to know this song, and I'm going to sing it as loud as possible. And just like your Aunt Tracy would, but hopefully my version is a little bit better. I went to a Springsteen concert with my sister once. She's the biggest Springsteen fan. We sit in the top row of the Verizon Center in D.C. And I had a seat that I was, I guess, one closer to the stage than her. Like, so the stage was on my side. And she just screamed the lyrics to every song the entire night in my ear and almost ruined the experience. It's hard to ruin a Bruce Springsteen concert, but she tried to do it. But Thunder Road might be that song.
Okay.
But the broadcast itself, Terry, getting back to things that didn't sound exactly great.
Tracy was screaming in your ear the whole time during the watching this.
It sounded like. I know these guys for Max Lax aren't pros, but it sounded like it. It was tough to watch. They talked over each other, screamed over each other at times. There were comments like, great defensive play by number 22, Sergio Perkovic. It was tough to watch.
Yeah, and I think that more than anything else, it shows how important preparation is for these types of broadcasts and how difficult the job actually is.
I'm not saying it's easy.
No, but I think what it says is that, and I've made this comment on Twitter, I don't know if I've said it on the podcast yet or not, there's no shame in just having crowd noise. No commentator is often better than bad. No commentary is often better than bad commentary. That's it. I don't. If you don't have anything nice to say, you might not.
I just
say
dropped
it
my
well.
Mic, and I was about to walk out.
there are a lot of people that are listening to this right now saying, like, wait, are you kidding me right now? I've been listening to this drill for 35 minutes, and you're going to tell me that no commentary is better than bad commentary?
So moving on to some other big games. We talked about, referenced it earlier. Terry and I had a fun Friday afternoon. We went and watched Virginia and Syracuse with some friends. And not only just a good time, but a great game, very entertaining game. James Pinnell, 4 goals, 1 assist for Virginia.
Brandon Mullins, please stay on a guy off ball.
Tim Barber, 5 points. Dylan Donahue, 5 points for Syracuse. A back and forth. You know, Syracuse came out on fire, took a 3-0 or 4-0 lead. Virginia fought back. They kind of found their legs underneath them and really made a game of it.
Yeah, and I think that, before even jumping into any more specifics, Dylan's one comment that will, and Dylan and Andy's one comment that will, persist with me through at least the next couple weeks, if not through the entire season, is just how tough it is to clear the ball sometimes. And it was particularly evident for Virginia, who had they had 3 failed clears in 10 attempts in the first half, and they ended up being perfect in the second half, and that was probably one of the biggest differentiating factors in terms of their ability to get back into the game. A couple of shout-outs to guys who impressed me. Sergio Salcido has emerged as a bona fide midfielder for the Orange. He had 2 goals and 2 assists. I believe he got the opening goal of the game and got another big one late. And it's nice that Syracuse knows who its top 6 offense is, particularly because there's so much talent. There's so many guys that will contribute this season, that haven't been as consistent a presence. Thinking specifically about Matt Lane, who looks like an absolute monster and has 2 goals and 4 assists in Syracuse's first 4 outings. You know, there are a few others that I think are in that mix as well. Nick Mariano has, I believe, with 3 goals in this one, solidified his place in Syracuse's offense. He seems like a little bit of a change of pace type attackman, which is probably a smart and interesting way to utilize him. There's a lot to be optimistic about, I think, if you're Syracuse. Whereas, there are probably some folks who are looking at a pair of 1-goal wins and saying that, there's been a little bit of regression since the Albany win 2 weeks ago. I shade the other way, where I see a lot of positivity coming out of Syracuse going forward. On the flip side, talking about Virginia in particular, bad day for Matt Barrett, only stopped 33%. So you wonder if he had had more of a typical day, how different that would have been. Some sloppiness from both defenses, but, from the Virginia end, I thought that Tanner Scales still, isn't all the way back from his injury. So a matchup, whether you're on a top flight attackman like Dylan Donahue or get bumped around, you know, it makes it a little bit difficult to build a defense around not knowing exactly how your senior captain is going to be able to handle his matchup on a day-to-day basis. And so, you know, that was another thing that I thought was a little bit problematic and difficult for the Virginia, you know, kind of defense to prepare around. Ryan Lukovic had his best game of the season, in my opinion, so far. You know, Zed Williams, they use him a lot. They use him in a lot of different ways, so the fact that he only had one goal isn't something that's a huge concern to me, but I do think you're starting to hear a little bit more about, well, maybe you need to get him some more runs at the defensive midfield so that he can go end to end and get a couple of easy goals that way before he starts contributing a little bit more offensively. AJ Fish, it's easy to understand why the coaching staff likes him. So I guess, you know, all in all, Virginia's 2-3, 0-1 in the ACC. I don't think that Syracuse at home was necessarily, if you were going to pick one, was necessarily the one that you were going to circle. You know, so for Dom and company, it's back to the drawing board, and you're going to figure out what games do we need to win, what games are we going to win in order to get back to the NCAA tournament.
One of the bigger upsets of the week, Georgetown 11, Hofstra 6. Ahoy has started strong, finished stronger, earning a much-needed 11-6 win against number 9 Hofstra. First win of the season for the Hoyas, and they bounce back from a midweek loss at Mount St. Mary's to move to 1-3. The Pride fall to 3-1. Georgetown freshman Dan Becerra led the Hoyas with 3 goals and added an assist, and Peter Conley had 2 goals and 4 assists. And future IL summer intern Joe Bucci scored the first 2 goals of the game for the Hoyas to get them off to a fast start.
So I think the other reason that I'm a little under the weather is because the sensory overload that I experienced from the hours of noon to about 2:30 on Saturday afternoon, it was you know, something out of a Clockwork Orange. It was ridiculous. I think so. We have in the aisle HQ newsroom area, 2 TVs on the wall, 1 computer underneath 1 TV, another laptop set up another one, and then we had 2 laptops, McNear and I, that we were working on, and a third that had a game on it. So there was legitimately 5 screens that had games on it, all within eye shot of one, you know, glance upward. And I don't think I recovered from it. That being said, this was one of them. Both these games that were played in Hofstra, this and the one that we'll talk about next, were on one of the big screens. And first of all, shout out to Lax Sports Network for a very nice job, both in terms of their run-up. I thought their Saturday morning content and coverage was really interesting, as well as their post-game, and a nice job executing the games from a live coverage perspective as well. You know, Peter Connolly having 2 goals and 4 assists, that's something that you're going to be really heartened by if you're Georgetown. I mean, he was your best player before going down with injury about 7 games into last season. So, getting that back is really exciting. I think that the story of this one, though, is that Hofstra was only able to put up 6 goals, 2 of which came from Josh Burns, 0 points of which came from Sam Linares. This is something that Matt Kinnear and I were trying to figure out. We didn't make note of who was covering whom. We just knew that I believe it's Christian Ford and Michael Mayer were each on one of the other. And so just credit to the pair, because obviously 2 points out of that group, out of that duo, is something to be excited about, something to be impressed with. And a building block for the Hoyas going forward. You know, this was a hinge point for their season. You come off a loss to Mount St. Mary at midweek. If you don't get this game and you're 0-4 with the schedule that, you know, still awaits them, I mean, obviously the Big East is there and you're always going to have an opportunity. But now you're 1-3. You've got Fairfield and Hobart, 2 very winnable games, and then you're at Duke. So if you're 3-3 going to Duke, and then having Loyola come to town, you know, you could very easily be 4-4 with 2 top 20 wins heading into your league schedule. It's a really good place to be.
The other game, part of that doubleheader, Harvard with an upset over Duke, 14-9. Harvard takes a 10-5 lead at halftime, and it just hangs on, withstands a bit of a Duke run at the end, but Devin Dwyer with 4 goals, 2 assists. Morgan Cheek with 3 goals, 3 assists for Harvard. They shut down Miles Jones with a very quiet day.
Yeah, so, you know, Miles being limited to 1 assist, you've started to hear some of the chatter about him as it relates to Wharton-type conversations. You know, I will maintain, and, you know, I'm willing to go down on this ship that he's the he's your leader in the clubhouse. He's your favorite at this point for the 2016 Thornton Trophy, and I still do think he's got some bounce-back games left in him. You know, that being said, you mentioned Devin Dwyer. He is in that conversation right now. To me, he's the best quarterback attackman. It kind of depends on how you define Cannizzaro. Is he a pure quarterback or is he more of a dodger? You know, Dwyer, while he had 4 goals and 2 assists in this game, has always been an assist-first type of guy. So, you know, if you want that passer quarterback, Dwyer is the best. He's the best at it right now in college lacrosse. He's leading the country in points per game with 6.6, and certainly deserves to be talked about among the best players. One offensive player that really jumped out for me, you mentioned Morgan Cheek, obviously with an overtime game-winning goal to his resume so far this year. He's deserved some attention. But Sean Coleman is a midfielder who has struggled with injuries over the course of his career, particularly coming out of LaSalle. And I'm impressed. He's a sophomore with 3 goals and 4 assists after 4 games. Coming out of the midfield, that's an impressive stat line. I think Sean Coleman has been a really significant factor for Harvard's emergence offensively, you know, to this point in the season. But you mentioned what Harvard was able to do defensively, and I think that it started with their ride. I believe Quinn called Duke's clearing game. They finished 16-25, 9 failed attempts, the worst in recent Duke lacrosse history in terms of the worst clearing day. And I think that there's probably a lot of truth to that. You know, sometimes those days happen, and John Donowski is a coach that can handle them better than most, better than all probably, and figure out a way to rebound and move forward. That being said, you know, this is a team that we had questions about toward the end of last season. You know, Miles Jones was nursing a hand injury. They did not look that great in the ACC championship against Syracuse. And then 2 weeks later had their season end to Ohio State. So there's a difference between not panicking and not identifying the things that need to be improved. And right now it appears that getting from defense to offense is something that needs to be improved for Duke. You know, they can win faceoffs, they can get stops defensively, they can make saves. But if they aren't converting their defensive possessions and stops into offense and then converting those into goals, it's very clear that they're going to continue to struggle. I tend to think that they're going to be okay. I tend to think that you're going to find some more offensive depth. You know, I tend to think that you're going to figure out some more easy ways to clear the ball. And you're not going to play a team like Harvard, who, first of all, is still establishing themselves on a national stage and clearly showed up to play. You know, Duke has a good one tonight against Richmond at 7 p.m., and it's another good test. Richmond has a reputation for being among the best riding teams in the country. If they clear the ball against the if they fail to clear the ball 9 times against the Spiders, I'm going to make sure that you check out the Epic Inside Lacrosse scoreboard, because you might be surprised by what you see on Monday night.
Yeah, and you're right. They'll have a chance to work out some of those kinks or to work on their clearing game against another team tonight. That game is on ESPN3 at 7 o'clock, Duke and Richmond. Terry, let's move on to your Twitter follow of the week. And I suggested last week that maybe it's just you and me, that it should be at Terrence Foy and at D_Fly for this week. We'd love to get your feedback. Let us know what you think of the podcast. If you have any suggestions, things we might be able to do, make it more enjoyable. We've tried to implement those over the weeks, and we will continue to do so. Again, that's at D_Fly, F-L-Y, and at Terrence Foy. But you had something about Twitter that you want to talk about. And then yeah. I have one thing too.
So I've been impressed by or interested in the increased disclosure of individual Maverick Cascade media poll voters' votes, which is to say posting your top 20 online after you've submitted or before. It doesn't really matter when. I decided I was going to do it for two reasons. The first is because the way that our voting system works, you don't see your votes from the previous week. You only see what the actual poll outcome was. So it was helpful. It has been helpful for me to know what my votes were the preceding week. It's very easy. You just scroll back through your own timeline and check it out. So I can make adjustments based on what my previous thoughts were. The second thing is, obviously, it solicits a lot of interaction. And typically, you know, that interaction has been very provocative and thought-provoking. I'm not somebody who's shy about defending my opinion, so I've enjoyed people coming at me with disagreements. And on the other hand, you know, I acknowledge that there were probably some questionable choices that have been made. And this is something that's picked up steam too. I remember Brian Huggins did this a few years ago, and that he was the first that I noticed do it consistently. But you know, just this week I saw Patrick McEwen, Anish Shroff, Casey Vach, Eamon McEnany all do it, and that obviously goes with Quint, who posts his poll every Monday on InsideLacrosse.com. I just think it's a cool development. You know, I don't know how frequent it is in other sports. I don't follow anybody that votes in the basketball or football polls. So, you know, I thought it was an interesting trend that is currently happening on Twitter.
One guy that I follow does it all the time. Seth Davis, CBS basketball guy, Sports Illustrated guy, does it. And each Sunday night he has a long session with what he calls his trolls and fields questions from them with Jay Billis-like sarcastic remarks oftentimes about how right Seth Davis is. It's funny. It's interesting. Fans love it, and I would encourage you to do the same. I want to give you my Twitter tip of the week. One thing that I do that I've been doing for a long time is I follow not many in my regular feed. I don't follow many people in my usual not the straight feed, but I make lists, and I have different lists for different subjects. So I have a soccer list when I'm watching a game. It's multiple politics, hoops, lacrosse, of course, football. So if I'm watching a Ravens game or something, I'm getting all just NFL writers, Ravens people, you know, other teams too I follow in there. And it's just a great way to follow along on a second screen while you're watching a game and be part of like another conversation, whether it's some other fan sites for the team you like plus national people who are covering the games. It's a very interesting way. So although my Twitter count main feed says I follow 79 people, probably follow about 1,000, and it's just broken up into different lists. And you can subscribe to people's lists, Terry. So,
including yours.
Yeah, so people could come and just subscribe to, you know, my lacrosse list or my hoops list and or my whatever list. My politics list is on point these days. Gives me both sides of the equation: Republican, Democrat, impartial people, some comedians on there. It's great during these presidential debates. It makes my night. That's my tip of the week. You're speechless.
I don't want to venture into the idea. I don't want to venture into the world of Twitter or politics. Twitter. I just don't think I have the energy.
There are some people that you just have to unfollow from time to time because they're just so party centric. But for the most part, the best guys are the ones who are – the comedians are the best, basically.
Yeah,
you can imagine which way most of them lean.
Right.
Moving on, Terry, to the games that are coming up.
The week ahead.
Yeah, the week ahead. This is a big weekend. The Cascade Maverick calendar is full of top 20 matchups. Everybody's got – you talk about the hunted. Tuesdays are for the hunters. Harvard and Albany, you think, should be on upset alert?
Yeah, so we've got 18 midweek games this year or this week, and I'm qualifying that as anything that's happening from between Sunday and Saturday, so basically Monday through Friday. And I would say that as of right now, as you look at the calendar, first of all, there are no midweek ranked matchups, so there are six ranked teams in action on Tuesday evening, and I think that number 15 Albany, hosting a UMass team that we spoke about a little bit, as the Minutemen are going to welcome the Tar Heels to town on Saturday. I think that the Great Danes should be on the lookout for UMass, and I also I think that Harvard, a team that is 4-0, has three overtime victories, and is traveling to Providence to take on the Bryan Bulldogs, a team that obviously has been able to beat some substantial foes in their past. I think, it's at some point we should have this conversation. Is Bryan's win over Syracuse in the first round of the NCAA tournament in 2014 the biggest upset in the history of lacrosse? But whether that's true or not, whether the answer is yes or no, the Bulldogs are 3-2. They're coming off of a 14-4 loss to Yale on Saturday, and their only other loss is a one-goal loss to Bucknell. So, by Bryan's standards, flying a little bit below the radar, three wins over Manhattan, Providence, and Hartford, I wouldn't be stunned. They're a team that can compete with Harvard. So, yeah, the Crimson and the Great Danes are the two that I have on upset watch for this week.
Other great games this week coming up, some broadcast games. ESPNU, 2 o'clock on Saturday. Hopkins with the top 10 number 6 ranked Towson Tigers. Welcome to the top 10 Towson Tigers.
Coach Sean Allen's team has the opportunity to sweep Baltimore with wins over UMBC and Loyola under their belt, taking on the Blue Jays. You know, this is it's funny to call Hopkins offense their strength right now, because they do, obviously, they're still recovering from figuring out who they are in the wake of the loss of Joel Tinney and the loss of Connor Reed. That being said, they put up 17 goals on Princeton.
Without Ryan Brown scoring
a goal. Yeah. And then a week prior, they gave up 15 goals to Carolina. So if you're gonna choose one end of the field for the Blue Jays, you're probably gonna choose the offense. And they're going up against, you know, at this point, I think Towson has to be, right now, I would say the four best defenses in college lacrosse are Yale, Notre Dame, Maryland, and Towson. And Towson might be the best out of it. So strength against strength in that way will be exciting. You know, I don't know if I have a matchup in this one to watch, because I think that Towson's close defense can be pretty multiple. Certainly who they put on Shaq Stanwyck and Ryan Brown is going to be the most interesting thing. You know, and I would expect Henry Cordes, he seems like the fastest of the three close defensemen, to be on Shaq. But, you know, it could be Lowe, it could be Gorman. We'll find out. I really don't have much of a sense. Maybe the matchup to watch is Ryan Brown, one of the best shooters, maybe the best feet set shooter in college lacrosse, against Tyler White, who I said last week is the best goalie in college lacrosse. That could be a fun one to watch. See how well Ryan Brown tests the big boy.
Yeah, I think that's the matchup within the matchup to watch would be Brown on White. Other game on TV, CBS Sports, 11 a.m. on Saturday, Duke at Loyola, and what should be another great game.
Yeah, so obviously lost a little bit of its luster as both teams are coming off of losses. Loyola's not on the weekend, the Wednesday prior against Towson. And also, you know, we mentioned or talked about at length the Duke loss to Harvard. That being said,
Loyola eked one out.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Their arch nemesis, the Holy Cross.
Achilles heel might be a little bit better of a term than arch nemesis. But, yeah, they went out to beautiful Worcester, Massachusetts, and escaped with a one-goal win. This has been a barometer game for the Greyhounds in the past, and I think that
do the Crusaders just match up well with them?
With Loyola? Well, last year it was a function, I think, very few people would dispute that the fact that the game started in clean weather and it had been 6 inches of snow in an orange ball. No, a white ball. And that was part of the dispute, was a big part of the outcome of the game. This one, it seemed like the Greyhounds fell asleep late and allowed the Crusaders to get back into it. But getting back to the Blue Devils matchup, first of all, you got to look at Loyola's ride and figure out whether or not they can duplicate what was bugaboo for Duke against Harvard. I think aside from that, you want to see Grant Lamone play as well as he did in the first couple of games against Duke. It just is so important for what Loyola wants to do in terms of his ability to make the save he's supposed to make, release their defensive midfielders, easy outlet pass, Loyola gets an offensive transition look. One of the comments that Dave Cottle made on that Towson broadcast that I thought was very apt was Loyola lacked depth at their short stick defensive midfield position. It looked like they got worn down late. So with a Duke offense that doesn't run a lot of midfielders, doesn't feel like they're going to be able to take full advantage of that. So that's potentially something that could be in Loyola's favor a little bit. And then at the other end of the field, I think Duke's defensive identity is still very difficult to quantify. So, you know, Loyola, one of the comments that's been made about them a few times is that they play offense in stages, you know, transition, early offense, and then they are very patient and settled once they get the ball into the position that they want it. This is not a game I have a prediction for. I wouldn't be surprised if Loyola won by one. I wouldn't be surprised if Duke won by seven.
And in the game of the week on Sunday, number one, Notre Dame, number two, Denver, this is a big one.
I have a prediction for this one.
Are these the two best teams in the country?
I don't understand how an opposite argument can be made. I mean, really, when you look at Yale being number four, Syracuse being number three, those are the two teams that you could potentially make an argument for. And I don't think that either has shown why they are better than Notre Dame or Denver right now. And I actually think, you know, I was communicating with former inside lacrosse coworker of mine, ours, and current Cascade brand manager, Ryan Demarest. He asked me what the biggest surprise of the season was so far. And my answer was, a lot of the things that you would potentially qualify as surprising, I'm not surprised by. Am I stunned that Hopkins, Carolina, or Virginia have struggled to some degree? Not particularly. Maybe the thing that's surprising me the most is that Denver and Notre Dame have met the hype, as odd as it is to say.
Okay.
But they're the clearly the two best teams in the country. And it sounds like, you know, folks that care about these types of nuances are glad. It sounds like this game's going to be outside. It's very difficult to play in the Moose Krause Center. I say that having played in the Moose Krause Center. It's cool. It's loud. I'm a goalie. It's not easy to play inside. But it sounds like this is going to be at Arlotta Stadium. It is on ESPNU. We're all going to be able to watch it. It's the day of the St. Patrick's Day Parade here in Baltimore. So that's got disaster written all over it for your boy.
What is your prediction for this game?
Well, I predict a 9-8 score. Don't necessarily have as strong of a feeling that, like, say, for example, the over-under was set at 17.5. I'd feel way stronger, and it was a pick either way. I would feel way stronger about taking the under than I would about any other bet. I think a 9-8 score is a very realistic, very likely outcome. And I'm going to pick the home team. I'm going to pick Notre Dame. I was impressed by what they were able to do late, making the one or two plays necessary to separate themselves from Maryland. It's not to say that I wasn't impressed by what Denver was able to do in order to come back, but I feel like Notre Dame is less likely to make some of the mistakes that North Carolina made that allowed Denver to get back into that one. What do you think?
I like that pick. I like an experienced Notre Dame team at home in a close one. I don't want to say 9-8. I'll say 11-10. Maybe okay. There's a few more goals scored. I'll go 11-10.
Well, Dan, we're going to close with a new feature this week.
Yes, we are.
So not too long ago, you know, like to consider myself a man of words, many words at times, for thousands and thousands of
them. There are quite a few podcast listeners who would agree with you.
Yeah. So I felt like it was appropriate to, in some sort of like aspirational, you know, kind of highfalutin type of way, include in my Twitter bio, I'm always on the search for new words to live by. I don't know what it says about me. I'm a moral relativist. Maybe it says that. But I put the challenge to you. It's going to be your job every week to come up with new words for me to live by, and we're going to close with that. So,
with that being said, I had many candidates for the first one, but today is a special day, Terry. Earlier today in the IL newsroom, we were watching the Peyton Manning press conference.
Oh, Lord.
No, what's that for?
Peyton Manning's retirement day does not qualify as a special day.
He was one of the greatest football players of all time. If you don't appreciate what he's done, then you hate sports. He's an ambassador of the game. He's pretty funny. He had a couple good lines in his speech where he was obviously very emotional. And, you know, he's been known to being so prepared. You know, so his preparation for games combined with the talent, you know, has helped him become the best and set records. And he prepared for his speech like he probably prepared for games and Super Bowls. He just did a great job. And he had a quote in there that I thought was really cool. And he said, "Treat a man as he is, and he remains the man that he is. Treat a man the way he should be, and he becomes that man." And I think those are some words to live by. And he was referencing his coaches and how they gave him a lot of great responsibility and sort of leeway to become a leader. And so be it, he did. And he became a champion. So those are my words to live by.
There might be a 140-character limit issue in that one. So how about dress for the job you want, not the job you have?
That's not what I said. This is more profound than that, but it's along those same lines.
Shout out to Peyton Manning. I agree. You know, he's a funny and easy target, but certainly I would trade careers with him pretty quickly. he amassed a tremendous two Super Bowl win career.
He won two Super Bowls for different teams. Only quarterback to ever do that. I'm not saying he's my favorite player of all time. I'm not even sure who that would be. But it's just it was a fitting quote on such a day of a legend saying goodbye.
Lamentable, Dan. Thank you so much.
And with that, we will say goodbye. We'll see you next week. Enjoy the games.